Today's Teisho will be on case 96 in the Heikigan Roku, the Bienlu. Case 96 is Joshu's three turning words. Main subject. Joshu said, clay Buddhas cannot pass through water. Metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace. Wooden burners cannot pass through fire. Secho's verse, clay Buddhas cannot pass through water. The divine light illumines heaven and earth. Had Shinko not stood in the way, many deceptions, many pretenses. Metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace. Men came to visit Shinko and found the warning notice on the board, but everywhere the gentle breeze. Wooden Buddhas cannot pass through fire. I always remember how the monk Hasoda broke down the oven of sacrifice whose god so long had bound himself. So I want to thank everybody again this morning for such wonderful sitting here and online. Some of you will be joining us in person this evening. It's so exciting. They're waiting for it. And there's, of course, it's wonderful to practice under any circumstances, but it's beautiful here today. The sun is shining, all the flowers are in bloom, and, you know, just wonderful. So some of you will be arriving this evening, eagerly awaiting your arrival. This is a wonderful koan. Joshu was just an amazing person. I've talked about him before. Joshu, when he was a very young person, like in his teens, He went to like Sesshin and had an awakening experience, had a kensho. Right? And sometimes people have a kensho and they think, okay, now I know, right? But for Joshu, that kensho experience was just the beginning of a long life of exploration into reality. And he eventually became the student of a very famous Zen master named Nan Chuan. And Nan Sen became his teacher for many years, for more than 40 years. They practiced together until Nan Sen died. And everybody expected that Joshu would become the abbot of Nan Sen's temple. But instead, Joshu decided not to take that position, and he went out on the road. And he visited Zen masters all over China. And his travels are famous in the world of Zen, and many of his encounters with other teachers are recorded in the koan collections. When Joshu was very old, according to the records, he lived to be 120. So when Joshu was 100 years old, he developed the Mu Koan, which we all use. A really remarkable teacher. And this koan is equally remarkable, I think. Clay Buddhas cannot pass through water. Metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace. Wooden burned Buddhas cannot pass through fire. See. So when we're practicing with our koans, koans are such wonderful, wonderful opportunities to wake up. Because we, you know, we bring to the koan our expectations and our understandings. And you know, when you begin to bring those to bear on the koan, in a certain way, it often defeats them. It often defeats them. And this can be really distressing, right? I mean, so when you are given a koan, if you have studied some of the Zen literature, you know, maybe you've read books on Zen, it's only natural, you know, to bring your reading to bear on what you on what you're doing. So, you know, years ago, I was training with a teacher who studied with a master named Soen Roshi, Nakagawa Soen Roshi. And the teacher, the American, Japanese teacher I was studying with here in the United States was named Edo Shimano. And Edo Shimano built a temple up in Livingston Manor, New York, which is quite beautiful. It's Japanese style building. One of his students was the president of the 3M Corporation. So big donation made that building possible. And sometimes a Soen Nakagawa Roshi would come and visit Edo Roshi at this temple in Daibosatsu Temple in Livingston Manor, New York. And Soen Roshi was Edo Roshi's teacher and also quite a respected Zen master. And, you know, there's a lake next to the Zendo called Beecher Lake. And old Nakagawa Soen would get up every morning early and swim in the summer and the spring in the cold water of Beecher Lake. So anyway, when I was studying with Edo Roshi, I noticed that a number of Edo Roshi's students who had heard this story of Nakagawa Roshi getting up in the morning and going to swim in Beecher Lake would get up in the morning and go to swim in Beecher Lake. So when I was training there, I noticed that, you know, we had to get into the Zendo by, I don't know what, 4:30, 5 o'clock. There would be a number of Edo's students who would, either before or after that, run down to the lake and swim in the lake. And at first I didn't know what the hell they were doing, you know. And then I myself heard this story about Soen bathing in the lake. You know, I thought it was interesting that these students were doing this, right? Why were they doing this? You know, they wanted to be like Nakagawa Soen Roshi. They wanted to experience his life, you know, his life, his enlightened mind by doing what he did, right? And I myself did not get up and go down and swim in the water, but I understand the motivation. But you know, actually, they were just imitating Nakagawa Soen. They weren't finding their own way to practice, if that makes any sense. They had they admired him, and that was a good thing. And they heard this story, and they thought, if I go down to the lake and swim, I can be like Nakagawa Soen Roshi. But you know, going down to the river or to the lake and swimming like Nakagawa won't give you Nakagawa's insight. You know, those students were doing something that's totally human, right? Totally human. But they were actually creating an obstacle for themselves instead of getting closer to his freedom. See, I hope I'm making some sense. You know, if you read a sutra, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, you know. You can bring to your practice this little slogan, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And it might seem to help you when you're working with your koan. You know, if you come into the zendo, into the dokusan room, however, and say form is emptiness and emptiness is form, you're just doing what those students did when they went down to swim in the lake, right? So, you know, koan training is so frustrating because we're trying to break through our illusions. But as we do that, we often ask our illusions to help us, right? It's so human. You know, so if I'm working on a koan, you know, it's only natural I would think of something in the sutras I've been reading and try to use that to apply it to my experience. It's the same thing, you know. The other day, I had to replace the pump in the toilet in our main bathroom. You know, the thing that flushes the water out and then brings the water back into the tank. So I had to drain the tank, and I didn't really know how to do this. So I went online and I found out. And, you know, it took me a little while, but I actually got it all together. It actually works. It was a miracle. Right? So it makes sense that when you're working with koans, you know, this is like a problem in a way, like fixing the toilet. You know, you would go to information, right? You'd go to get information. And you might reach in your mind and remember something you'd read in a sutra. And then present it in Dokusan, right? And it's only natural we do that. You know, everything in our lives has this character where, you know, we're using what we, what has worked for us in the past, or we're using what we admire, or we're following the models of people we admire. And we're imitating their behavior. And, you know, that's a good thing in a way, right? I mean, one of the reasons I became a teacher was because I had some really wonderful teachers. You know, at some point I was sitting in an English class and I was listening to a professor in my undergraduate days talk about literature. And I thought to myself, damn, that is the most interesting thing I have ever heard, you know? I mean, I remember reading myth criticism, and we were reading Joseph Campbell in there. And my professor was funny, and he was smart, and he seemed to know everything about everything. And I guess at some point I said, you know, I want to be like that. You know, I'd like to be like that. And so I decided to become an English teacher. And I'm so glad I met him, and I'm so glad I followed his example. There's a danger to this, right? Where, you know, if you have to fix the toilet, please don't try to invent fixing the toilet yourself, or you'll spend the rest of your life trying to fix the toilet. It's good to go to the internet or read the instructions on the unit before you try to install it. But a Zen practice is really different. Really different from that. You know, Because you know, when we bring into the Dokusan room our experience of our the models we have gained from reading Zen literature or other things, or when we bring into the Dokusan room things we've read, you know, and so on, you know, we're doing something. We're actually, in a way, creating a new barrier for ourselves. You know, basically, if you want to be, you know, we have a Manjushri here on the altar, and there's a Buddha in the dining room. They're both these beautiful statues. The Manjushri comes from Nepal. And I've been wanting to get a Manjushri statue for the longest time. So a few years ago, it might have been just before COVID, I actually talked to some people and found this reputable place where you could get one of these statues. And I looked at it online, and I thought it was so beautiful, and I sent away for it. And it's, you know, I think it's inspiring. I come in sometime and I look at that statue, and it's beautiful, and Manjushri has her sword, or his sword. You know, in the dining room, the Buddha is presiding over us as we eat. And, you know, if people ask me, are you a Buddhist? I definitely say, yes, I'm a Buddhist. So you know, we need you to get into to decide what you want to do with your life. It helps to have a professor who becomes a model. You know, the Buddhist statue is a emblem of a person who's enlightened. Manjushri is an emblem of an enlightened being also, right? Bodhisattva of wisdom. We humans, we need ideas, we need examples, we need instructions, to live our lives, right? We wouldn't be here if there wasn't somebody called the Buddha, if he didn't have a life story that involved awakening, and so on. So, you know, I myself read a lot of philosophy. You know, I will read an article over and over again, trying to get it in my head and figure it out. And, you know, sometimes I read these things that are just so difficult. You know, I surprise myself. You know, I'll pick it up later and think, oh, this doesn't make any sense at all. How did I ever understand this? And so we need these things. We need these things, right? But on the other hand, all of these are sort of like the clay Buddhas, the metal Buddhas, and the wooden Buddhas that Joshu is talking about, right? And in a way, he's talking about Buddha statues, right? So in China, there were a lot of, and in India especially, there are a lot of terracotta Buddha statues. And people would have those in their homes, inexpensive terracotta Buddha statues. We have like a brass Buddha statue in the dining room, and a brass Manjushri here in the Zendo. And also there are wooden ones. You've probably seen those too, you know. And Joshu says, you know, we need the Buddha statues, but you know, a clay Buddha can't survive floods, right? Can't survive floods. A metal Buddha won't survive in a furnace. And wooden Buddhas won't survive in a fire. So you know, basically he's saying, in a way, we need these things, but they become obstacles. They become obstacles, right? They can't survive they're not going to help us. Right? They're not going to help us. And in the poem here, the final stanza of the poem is, wooden Buddhas cannot pass through fire. I always remember how Hasoda broke down the oven of sacrifice where the god had so long bound himself. And this story is not familiar to people in our culture. So let me just read you the commentary. The episode refers to, the episode referred to here made Hasoda famous. One day, accompanied by his disciples, he went into a village shrine where there was an oven which the villagers worshipped as their tutelary god. Birds and beasts offered as sacrifice were killed and cooked in the oven. Hasoda struck the oven 3 times with his staff and said, "You were originally made of clay. Where could you have got this soul and godhead, which requires so much killing and cooking?" Thereupon, the iron of the oven came tumbling down. From among the dust and debris appeared the figure of a man dressed in a blue costume and wearing a crown. He stood before Hasoda and, making vows, said, "I was the god of the oven. I was long subject to the effects of karma. Today you gave me instructions and I was emancipated from my life of suffering. Now I am in heaven. I have come especially to give you my thanks." Hasoda said, "No nature is your original nature. I have not given it to you." Okay. Then the figure disappeared. Okay, and Hasoda's nickname is Hasoda. This is basically goes back to Mandarin. Break oven down. That was his Dharma name after that. So you know, the idea is that there's this oven, and the god of the oven is worshipped by the people in this town, and they. And they make sacrifices. They make sacrifices to the god, all these animals. And one day Hasoda goes in and he hits the oven with his staff and shatters it. And the god of the oven, who is being worshipped by all these people, is set free from the oven, see? And he said, my karma has put me here. And I've actually, even though these people were bringing me offerings, I've been a prisoner of the oven. And you have finally set me free. And Hasoda says, your true nature is no nature. Right? So this is such a wonderful story, and it ties in with what Joshua was saying, when I was in college, I had these professors in English and anthropology who were so fascinating, and I wanted to be like them, and I'm so glad I followed their example. Basically, I had many challenging moments on the way to my job, right? I had to work really hard, and the road was not always successful. I had many sleepless nights. I remember writing my first article, and I had every detail. I kept going over and over because I didn't want to make a mistake. And before it went to press, there was like a basic date. A date was wrong, like this major date. I'd gone through. And it was just like, oh my God, you know, what's gonna, you know, I don't know if anybody read the article. So much stuff gets published that nobody reads, you know, and probably nobody would have known the date, even if they were specialists. But, you know, I've had many moments like that, right? And, you know, when I first started training with Genki Roshi, you know, I would sometimes recite poetry and things like that. I was trying to show him my love of literature. And one time he said, you know, you recite a lot of poems, so why don't you bring me your own poem? You know, and I was a little bit stung by the by his response, but it was delivered in the nicest way. And it took me a long time to understand he wasn't really asking for a poem. You know, he was asking me to discover my no nature. I was bringing into him my graduate English student nature, right? Which is really important. I'm not putting it down. You know, where I worked so hard to be an English teacher, right? But you know, in a certain way, if that's who I think I really am, I'm like the god of the oven. I'm trapped in the oven. There was a person here who was sitting with us for a little while. He doesn't sit with us anymore, but he is a pathologist at Robert Wood Johnson. And his job is to like go through all of this, these lab assessments of people and decide, you know, what to make of this. So he has to go through and look at, and a lot's riding on his research, right? I mean, basically, he has to look at like cells and decide if they're cancerous. And he has to look at, you know, photos of structures, biological, and decide if it's a tumor, that kind of, and that's really like very important. People's lives are at stake in all this, right? And he was my student for a little while, and for a couple of years, and then, you know, I had given a talk about not knowing, the importance of not knowing, and he asked to talk to me, and he was really mad at me. He was really furious at me. He said, you know, you're laughing, you're talking about not knowing, about letting life guide you. And he said, you know, I'm a pathologist. I have to make the right call. I have to make the right call. I can't laugh. You know, I can't trust. I have to go over this stuff again and again. And, you know, he really wanted me to know that he didn't approve of what I was saying. I see his point, right? But, you know, I think the conversation wasn't really about this matter. You know, I think it was really maybe about his identity, right? I mean, I think he saw himself a certain way, and I was saying, you know, basically, yes, this is really, you're doing a wonderful thing for human beings. You know, you're doing a wonderful thing for human beings, but, you know, that's not all there is to you. You know, that's not your, so to speak, that's not your true nature. And you know, not everybody welcomes that information, right? That can be deeply threatening to people. At least that's how I read the situation. Maybe I'm rationalizing. But, you know, I'm not putting down, I wasn't putting down his work as a pathologist, you know. But in a way, I think he was kind of a prisoner of his pathologist identity. I don't think he should be casual about looking at people's tumors or potential tumors. But I think that when we discover our no nature, it's a liberation like nothing else, right? I mean, I find that when I have to do something that's challenging, if I say to myself, I cannot fail at this task, I cannot. Or if I say, my life is on the line, or my self-respect is on the line, something like that. You know, this is the thing that's going to make or break my career, or this is the thing that's going to make or break my reputation. You know, that's a terrible thing to do to yourself, right? You know, I think it's much more, it's a much better situation if you can step out of yourself and just let the process unfold naturally, right? It's like, I was listening to this musician being interviewed on the radio, Lenny Kravitz. I don't know if you know who Lenny Kravitz is, but he's a rock musician, and he was talking about his method. And he said, you know, I dream music. You know, he said, I'll wake up and I have a tune in my head and I'll immediately write it down. And he said, I don't know where it came from. It just pops into my head and I write it down. Later I work on it, you know, I develop it into something. But he says, this has gone on for years. And, you know, if you read about creative people, so often, you know, they definitely don't sit down and say, I can't make mistakes. I have to do the right thing, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So often, you know, it's like they're just waiting for inspiration. You know, a lot of the time, you know, waiting for inspiration means you get up every day and you write and you see what turns up, and sometimes it's great and sometimes it's not. You make a discipline out of waiting for inspiration. If you just wait for inspiration, nothing might happen. But if you get up and you have to write, or you get up and you paint, sometimes it's not much of a painting, but sometimes, you know, it's like lightning strikes. So I think that it really helps, you know, to allow ourselves to forget the small self and to trust in the big self. And trusting in the big self means, you know, basically not relying really on anything. It's difficult to do, but not relying on anything. Just, you know, basically putting yourself in the hands of the universe, you know, so to speak. And how do we do that? Well, in Zen, we go into deep mushin and we trust the big mind to take us somewhere. It's like 100% trust-based, right? And it's so hard to do this, you know. For many years, when I would be given a koan, I would I couldn't help myself. You know, I would think it out. And I would come in to see the Roshi and I would say, well, you know, it's non-duality, isn't it? And Genki would just ring the bell. Because, you know, okay, it's non-duality, but what does non-duality really mean in my life, for me? And I didn't know. You know, so I was grabbing an idea called non-duality and I was using it. I was making a wooden Buddha out of it, or a metal Buddha out of it. And when Genki rang the bell, he was setting my wooden Buddha on fire. And he was saying, see, that Buddha can't survive this. You know, your clay Buddha can't survive water. You know, and I was left with nothing, right? But that's the real Buddha. That's when we begin to encounter the real Buddha. It's only natural to offer an intellectual response. But you know, when that fails, you know, then we're thrown back on something deeper. And Zen is about really living our lives from that something deeper. You know, our true nature is no nature. True nature is no nature. It's so challenging in a way to take that seriously, right? You know, if you go to medical school, you work. You know, you do your undergraduate, and then you have all these years of medical practice. Then you do your internship, which is this incredibly hellish experience for a lot of people. And then you practice medicine, and it's a challenge every day. And, you know, it makes sense that somebody would say, well, finally, I'm a doctor, right? I'm finally a doctor. And if you're a doctor, that's the most wonderful thing. You know, you help all of these people. But actually, you know, if you cling to your identity as a doctor, it doesn't necessarily even help you be a good doctor. And it's not who you really are, right? It's not who you really are. You know, all of these identities, you know, are just like games we play or masks we wear. And ideas are like that too. You know, ideas are also like games we play or masks we wear. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but you know, when I was in undergraduate, my best friend was a philosophy major. And you know, we would get into these arguments that would go on for days. And you know, we got so vehement, it was almost like sometimes we wouldn't be talking to each other, you know. And then, you know, like 3 months later, it was like, who cares? You know, we've moved on. Those ideas seem so old and stale, right? It's like, you know, we were ready to punch each other, and now it's like, oh, who cares? That's just so-and-so. You know, we've moved on to the next chapter. But you know, when we're in those ideas, they seem so compelling, right? When we are out of them, we can feel bereft, but actually there's great freedom in that state of not knowing, right? Not having. When your wooden Buddha is burned up in the fire, it's a terrible thing for a little while. But now you're in this place where, you know, you don't know where to look, or you know, you don't know where to look. You don't know what to do. And that's koan practice, right? And that's really, you know, we all have those moments where that happens. And even though we dread them, you know, the Buddhist view is that when that happens, that is a chance to see that true nature is our true nature is no nature, right? Webb's Dharma, when Webb and his teacher, Webb Roshi, and his teacher, Miyoshi Kanko, after World War II, Miyoshi Kanko wanted to go to China. The Japanese invaded China and did terrible things in China. So Miyoshi Kanko wanted to return to China, and in the, I think it was the 80s, he, Webb, and Miyoshi Kanko went back to our temple, our mother temple in Suzhou called Han Shan Temple, and met the abbot there, as I understand, and the abbot's name in English was Nature of Sky. Nature of Sky, like empty sky. See, his name was Nature of Sky. So our nature is Ao Zhou, is Lan Tian, blue sky. Our true nature is no nature. You know, and that, people run from that, but actually that's the road to awakening. And so, you know, the, even though nobody wants to be stymied in their koan practice, you know, when you have lost, when the fire has melted your bronze Buddha or burned up your wooden Buddha, or when the water has washed away your clay Buddha, right now you have, you are really closer to your true nature than you've ever been. And that's why we do sesshin, right? I mean, some people will say, oh, I couldn't get up at 4:30 in the morning, impossible. That's just not who I am, right? It's so clear, so sad, right? You mean you didn't experience enlightenment because you couldn't get up in the morning? Really? I'm not belittling them. I'm saying that they are prisoners of their identity. When I first went to sesshin, I didn't get up at 4:30 in the morning, that's for sure. And it was like being on LSD trip or something, getting up so early in the morning. I felt terrible. But you know, it was so interesting, right, to get up at 4:30 in the morning. Everything was different. Everything was new. I remember getting up and I just wanted to splash some water on my face. And where we were having our sesshin was at like this Boy Scout camp in Washington State. And there was a big sink, a big zinc sink. And the water was leaking out of the spigot, and there was a light on. It was still dark, and there was a light on. And the water was coming out of the spigot, and it was dropping onto the zinc sink and making like a little drumming sound. And this was after a couple of days of zazen. And you know, I just looked at that water falling down, and it was just like, It was just like I felt so alive and so at ease, just staring at this water coming out of this spigot. And the sesshin was very hard. My legs hurt so much. But I think moments like that just kept bringing me back. It's like when I experienced that and saw it through the eyes of my known nature, it was so alive. I felt so wonderful to be looking at this water flowing out of this spigot. You know, if I went back the next day and turned on the spigot and looked at the water, it wouldn't happen again, right? It wouldn't happen again. You know, whatever happened to Soen Roshi, when he went down to the lake to swim, you're not going to capture that by going down to the lake and swimming the way Soen Roshi did, right? That's not going to do it. And even if someone Roshi did it a second time, it wouldn't bring it, wouldn't bring the magic. You know, the way we have to do this is constantly clearing away. Actually, melting is our method, right? You know, melting the Iron Buddha, melting the burning up the wooden Buddha. That's the method of Zen. You know, one by one, all of our Buddhas are dissolved. And we see our true nature, the nature of sky. And, you know, for many of us, this is day two of Sesshin. This is a very challenging day, right? This is when all the Buddhas are getting melted. So it's challenging, right? They can include our, we have physical resources that we rely on, and they even they fail us, right? Even our physical resources fail us, right? And then something wonderful can happen. Main subject, Joshu said, clay Buddhas cannot pass through water, metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace, wooden burners cannot pass through fire. Setcha's verse, clay Buddhas cannot pass through water, the divine light illuminates heaven and earth. Had Shinko, that's the second ancestor, who waited outside Bodhidharma's cave, had he not stood in the snow, so in other words, Bodhidharma let him sit out there for a while, and finally he became Bodhidharma's student. If he had gone home and not sat in the snow, Zen wouldn't have come to China. Many deceptions, many pretenses. Metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace. Men came to visit Shiko and found the warning notice on the board and everywhere the gentle breeze. Wooden Buddhas cannot pass through fire. I always remember how the monk Hasoda broke down the oven of sacrifice whose god so long had bound himself. So we have all bound ourselves. That's the truth. And we've come here to unbind ourselves. When the Buddha referred to his awakening, he called it unbinding. It's like, I've taken off my chains. So that's the work of today. Please keep up the good work.